Agency in the Palestinian Authority.
بالتزامن مع انعقاد مؤتمر المانحين في العاصمة البلجيكية.
We are holding this press conference based on our Palestinian people's demands all over the world. At the same time, the international conference for UNRWA is being held in Brussels. UNRWA has been suffering from a critical impasse, and the victims of the shortage of aids are the poor Palestinian refugees. We are all united in expressing that we won't give up our right of return, and we have been calling for this right for 73 years. The international community is now in front of the real test whether to be committed to its conventions or not.
The framework for cooperation between the UNRWA and the U.S. for 2021-2022 calls for restoring U.S. funding to the UN agency after it was cut off for 7 years under former U.S. President Donald Trump. It includes that the U.S. will not make any contributions to UNRWA except on the condition that UNRWA ensures that no part of the U.S. contribution is used to assist any refugee receiving military training as a member of the Palestinian Liberation Organizations.
We are calling the donor countries to support the issue of Palestinian refugees that was founded basically by U.S. UNRWA has been the only witness for all the violations of Palestinians' rights, and the international community should maintain a long-term and sustainable fund to support Palestinian refugees until they gain their freedom. This is a systematic conspiracy to demolish the issue of Palestinian refugees.
UNRWA provides services, especially in health and education, for more than 5.5 million Palestinian refugees. Palestinians say that UNRWA must remain committed to its duties until their right of return is guaranteed. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The Joint Conference of Syrian and Russian Committees formed last year on Syrian refugees' return was held in Damascus. Syria's Minister of Local Administration said amnesty decrees and investment laws issued by Syria proves the government's genuine desire for refugees to come back. Officials said hundreds of thousands of refugees returned in the past years.
We formed two committees from Russia and Syria for implementing steps for refugees' return. Over 2 million displaced Syrians returned so far. Nearly 1 million of them came from foreign countries. There are 13 border crossings fully ready to receive refugees. Return of displaced resulted in dismantling 26 temporary shelters this year.
Syrian Foreign Ministry officials asserted that the government continues to repair the infrastructure and restore basic services to areas liberated by the Syrian government from terror, noting to some obstacles in the face of refugees, such as U.S. and Turkish occupation of Syrian soil, support to terrorist groups, and looting natural resources.
The Syrian government continues to take all measures for Syrians' return. Our efforts are faced by some conspiring countries' attempts to take advantage of the refugees' issue politically and exercise systematic misleading campaign that the situation is unstable, as well as lies that refugees are in danger if they return.
Russian President's special envoy told Press TV that the West started to realize they should shift their policy towards Syrians' repatriation.
Western countries were doing everything possible, and there was huge information and campaign against what has been done here, you know, and they were trying just to convince everybody that the conditions are not ready for the Syrian refugees to return. It comes to this, to the understanding of the Western countries that they have to start to be more active themselves now. I think that's a good start. It takes, they need time, of course, because they cannot just change completely their policy.
11 agreements and one contract have been prepared to be signed between Syria and Russia in the fields of education, medicine, culture, science, and industry. The gradual restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, as well as the enhancement of economic ties with the country's neighbors, constitute a spark of hope for all Syrian refugees that their homeland started its journey of recovery from war, a fact that represents a solid encouragement for their return. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
crying, seeking the dead body of their beloved son. The relatives of Mudassir Gul, a doctor by profession, was killed on Monday, along with other civilians and two fighters, during a gun battle in Srinagar.
Authorities say he was involved with fighter and killed in crossfire. We know he was an innocent. Now that he is dead, at least return his dead body. The police have denied us his last rites.
The military operation took place on Monday evening in Srinagar, the main city of Muslim-majority Kashmir. According to police reports, the fighters had holed up in a building in the Hyderabad area and were eliminated by the government forces. The Inspector General of Kashmir Police, while talking to the media, said,
"The building owner was killed in a crossfire, while the fourth person was an overground worker, OGW, who was provided his rented space to Haider, foreign fighter, for using the same as militant hideout."
The building owner's daughter, however, accuses the government forces of using his father as a human shield.
"Security forces took my father inside the building, not once but thrice. On the third turn, he did not return, and they say he was killed in crossfire. Now that they have killed my innocent father, they must return his dead body."
The police chief said, fearing law and order problems, the dead bodies were not handed over to the families for last rites.
"It is not sure whether a militant bullet or the bullets fired by forces hit him. It would be clear after investigations whose bullet hit him."
Following the COVID-19 pandemic protocol, the authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have denied the last rites to the families of fighters killed during the military operations in Kashmir since 2020. Dozens of fighters have been buried at far-off locations, guarded and inaccessible to families. More recently, Kashmir's tallest pro-freedom leader, Sayyid Ali Gilani's family, was also denied his last rites, something for which New Delhi was highly criticized.
"Although having a decent burial is a fundamental right, here in Kashmir, it is seen as a breeding ground for anti-India sentiments and irregularities. Human rights defenders say denying families a proper funeral for their loved ones is a gross violation of human rights and a reason for unending pain for their kin." Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qumi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that two neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
"Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region."
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
"Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the two sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks."
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group, which calls itself Moses' Staff, has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data, which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, 6 Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnea. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations, but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Iman Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, who locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking. Just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation, but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Pourriza, Liverpool.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we completed explanation of Surah Qaf, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Zariyat, which is 51st in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Mecca and has 60 ayahs. It opens with a divine oath on the scattering winds that blow far and wide with the rain-bearing clouds, followed by other signs of God's mercy that are evident in the orderly world of nature. The surah derives its name from Zariyat, which means the scatterers, and mentions several signs of nature as proof of the resurrection after death for the final judgment. The disbelievers are reminded of the fate that befell rebellious generations of the past, and the prophet is urged to carry on reminding. The surah also refers to Prophet Abraham's hospitality towards the angels who conveyed to him God's message of a child to be born to him in this old age. It also relates the destruction of the nation to which Lot was sent as prophet, and mentions several other prophets such as Moses and Noah, as well as the erring nations of Ad and Thamud. According to a narration from the Prophet of Islam's 16th infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, the one who recites Surah Zariyat in the day or at night, God Almighty will improve his life, provide him with abundant sustenance, and illuminate his grave with a light shining till the day of resurrection, provided that he acts upon Quranic injunctions. Now we present you the first four ayahs of this surah.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wal Dhariyati Dharwa. Fal Hamilati Wiqra. Fal Jariyati Yusra. Fal Muqassimati Amra.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. By the scattering winds that scatter the clouds, by the rain-bearing clouds laden with water, by the ships which move gently on the sea, by the angels who dispense livelihood by his command. This surah begins with references to the natural phenomena, as well as ships that sail on the seas as a result of the intellect that God has granted to mankind, and to the angels, which are invisible instruments of divine power entrusted with the task to ensure the orderly functioning of the world and the whole universe. No doubt, the life of human beings, animals and plants depends on rain, and in this regard, winds play a prominent role in moving clouds for the showers over different areas. And this means the world and the universe have not been created without any purpose, as the disbelievers and the atheists think. Once the Prophet's first infallible heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, while delivering a sermon from the pulpit, was asked by a person, "What is Zariyat?" And he said, "The winds." When asked the meaning of the next divine oath in this surah on the word Hamilat, he said, "The clouds carrying rain." The questioner then asked the meaning of Jariyat, that flow with ease, as mentioned in the third ayah, and he said, "The ships, which mankind has manufactured thanks to God-given intellect." On the next divine oath that mentions Muqassamat, he said, "The angels." Thus, these ayahs refer to the scattering of matter, carrying of energy, and flowing of bodies in the role of nature, which are controlled and administered by various agencies appointed by the Almighty Creator. Even the microscopic corpuscles in the blood of living beings, which distribute sustenance, are controlled and regulated by such agencies. So man's attention is drawn to the reality of the universal plan, not haphazard, but governed by precise laws and a purpose pointed out in the next two ayahs of this surah. These ayahs teach us that, number one, emphasis on natural phenomena like rain, wind, and cloud make us discover the forces of nature that govern the world in an orderly way, thereby increasing our cognition of the Almighty Creator. And number two, without rain, the lands will become desolate. And without the gift of intellect, mankind would not have been able to invent ships, vehicles, aircraft, and so many other things that have ensured the steady progress of human societies since the dawn of creation. Now listen to ayahs 5 and 6 of the same surah.
إِنَّمَا تُوَعَدُونَ لَصَادِقٌ وَإِنَّ الدِّينَ لَوَاقِعٌ.
Indeed, what you are promised is true, and indeed, the retribution will surely come to pass. God Almighty fulfills the promises given to mankind during the mortal life of the transient world, as well as in the hereafter. His manifestation of omnipotence are visible in the world of nature. He alone fulfills his promises, including the rewards, punishments, paradise, and hell, which are all true. Likewise, the resurrection and assembling of all mankind and jinn on the promised day of judgment is indeed an occurrence without the least doubt. These ayahs teach us that, number one, whatever God has promised and conveyed through the prophets is true without the least doubt. And number two, we should thus believe in the divine words and await the rewards of our deeds in the world rather than being misled by the empty promises of fellow humans, most of whom are devoid of any fairness. Let us listen to ayahs 7, 8, and 9 of Surah Zariyat.
وَالسَّمَاءِ ذَاتِ الْحُبُكِ إِنَّكُمْ لَفِي قَوْلٍ مُخْتَلِفٍ يُؤْفَكُ عَنْهُ مَنْ أُفِكُ.
By the sky full of adornment with stars, Indeed, humankind are of different opinions. He's turned away from it, that is, the Quran, who has been turned away from the truth. The divine oath here refers to the immense masses of galaxies appearing as shining stars, which modern-day scientists are just beginning to discover by means of telescopes that they have invented by the gift of intellect provided by God Almighty. Here the Noble Quran mentions the vast sky and the countless galaxies still unperceived by science and technology. The next ayah means to say that the insensible persons may utter different words at different times, but there is only one straight path that leads to paradise, in spite of differing opinions of the disbelievers regarding resurrection. Ayah 9 refers to the causes of deviation from the true path, and means to say those who refuse to acknowledge sound arguments or submit to reason, they have deviated from belief in God, the message of the prophets, the teachings of the infallible imams, and the reality of the day of resurrection. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, the vast universe with its fascinating appearance, such as the stars that adorn the sky and are actually far away, planets are beyond the perception of mankind, however scientifically advanced. Number two, the words of the deniers of the hereafter are not based on logic and are full of contrast. Number three, the right path is one, but the paths of deviation are countless. And number four, any deviation and sin will set the ground for other deviations and sins, thereby making the way for returning to the truth more difficult.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. More than 6.5 years have passed since Saudi Arabia initiated its onslaught on the Yemeni people, a violent bombing campaign of the infrastructure as well as civilian areas caused an extensive amount of damage, and more importantly, it caused the loss of so many lives. However, the tide has changed as the Yemeni army currently has the upper hand and is now on the verge of taking over the oil-rich city of Ma'arib. Is defeat near for the Saudis and all of their allies from the Persian Gulf to the West? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight. I'm going to start this discussion now crossing over to Sana'a, talking to Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Abdul Latif, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the latest situation on the ground there.
Thank you so much. Actually, the Yemeni army managed to liberate the Al-Falaj area in Ma'arib. The Saudi of the coalition have a military checkpoint in that area, and so many travelers have been or have got kidnapped in that military point. It is the eastern gate to Ma'arib Jabal al-Nayef. The Yemeni army managed to liberate this area, and this is an important point for the Yemeni army and important advantage for the Yemeni army to keep encircling the city and liberate the city from the Saudi bankers and also from the terrorist groups. Actually, the leader of the Al-Qaeda in the Philippine Peninsula, Khalid al-Assad, he admitted that they have been fighting alongside the Chinese Republican forces in 11 military fronts, including Marib. He said that their participation is inconsistent, and no one can deny that. And this admission refutes the allegations of the Saudi-backed forces and the Saudi-backed coalition that they are not using terrorists to fund Yemeni army. Yemen's armed forces have been saying that for 7 years, that they are not fighting only the invaders, but also the terrorist groups, whether in Marib or in Al-Zayba or Taiz or Hudaybah or the front across the country. In Al-Hudaybah, the Emirati-backed forces have suddenly withdrawn their forces from so many areas, and I believe that they will continue their withdrawal to lift the city for the enemy army to control the city. Military experts say that this withdrawal comes in the process of gathering the forces to protect the Arab members of the state and also to protect the south of Yemen, as the Yemeni army is liberating Marib just a matter of time, and they want to lift Marib and think about what will be after the falling of Marib in the hands of the Yemeni army.
All right, thanks so much. That was our update out of Sana'a from our correspondent on the ground there, Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Now I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hausa, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Hausa with Brett. As time goes on, why does it appear to be more difficult for the Saudis to inflict defeat on the Yemeni army?
I think the main reason for this is that the Saudis have gone to war with much the same strategy as their overlord, so to say, the Americans, and the Israelis have always been doing. That is the shock and awe strategy, the idea that by overwhelming them with military hardware, with military prowess and power, by a massive display of what you can field in battle, that will overwhelm the enemy in to such an extent that they will completely collapse, that their morale will collapse, and you can basically take over the country in a matter of weeks. That's the idea, the strategy, the doctrine that is behind a lot of the invasions that the United States has waged in the past 20 years. It is the strategy behind what the Israelis are doing in Palestine for decades now. And it's the same doctrine that the Saudis have been trying to use. Unfortunately for them, the shock and awe doctrine is completely and utterly useless against a nation that is united in a common cause, because you cannot defeat a country with military hardware alone, especially if that military hardware, like the Saudis and the Americans and the Zionists, when that military hardware is specifically aimed at air superiority, and that is what we have seen for so long already. One of the first things that the Saudis did when they attacked Yemen is almost completely destroy the Yemeni Air Force, and that's why up until this point the Yemeni Air Force is nearly non-existent indeed. The Yemeni Air Force as a unit still exists, but a majority field drones and other unmanned aerial vehicles. They don't have any airplanes. So Saudi Arabia still maintains air superiority, just like the Americans have done when they invaded Afghanistan, when they invaded Iraq, and still like what the Zionists have over Palestine right now. But the problem is, you cannot defeat a country like that. You cannot win a war just by bombing alone. You can win battles, you can advance rapidly, but you cannot maintain. And that is exactly what has been happening here. The Saudis have been overwhelming the Yemenis in the beginning of this war, have been advancing many, many hundreds of kilometers into Yemeni land, but they have not been able to really capture large territory of, like, large population centers, especially in the north and in the west, where the population of Yemen is majority local.
So was it, let me just jump in here, was it a total miscalculation? Let me throw this, let me cross over to London and say it, Mohsen. How do you see it? Was there a total miscalculation going into this to begin with by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, by their those who support them, like the Americans and the Brits?
I think there was a huge miscalculation. I mean, they called it the Operation Decisive Storm, precisely because they thought that it would be all done and dusted within 3 or 4 weeks. That's exactly what bin Salman, who initiated this this war, thought, what he intended. Of course, that comes as a complete shock to them that it it hasn't worked out that way. The American intelligence has obviously failed on this. The Zionist intelligence has failed on this in terms of giving the Saudis insufficient reports on what the Yemeni morale was, what the Ansarullah's morale was, what their capabilities were. Those capabilities, of course, have grown rapidly during the war since 2015. But at that time, clearly they got some very, very bad intelligence. And what actually has transpired is that the Saudis have now spent in excess of $300 billion on a war against almost the poorest, if not the poorest, nation on the Arab Peninsula. And in return, they've really failed in every target that they had. In fact, the reverse has happened. The Yemeni Ansarullah forces have not only held them up till 2018, but actually in 2018 turned the tables on them and actually went for the jugular, went on the offensive. And that offensive is absolutely mind-boggling, because the equipment of the Yemenis, the tactics of the Yemenis, the strategies of fighting, etc., have been absolutely amazing and a real kind of eye-opener for any military.
What do you think has been key in that, Syed Mohsen? You talked about the offensive and how they have turned the tables. I mean, what has been key in that, being able to turn the tables, even though you just pointed out rightfully it's totally inequitable if we compare the type of equipment that both sides have?
Well, number one, the Yemenis have a huge faith. This is really not to be underestimated. Their spiritual and religious commitment to anti-oppression, towards the anti against tyranny, against the Saudis' tyranny, of course, but also the Zionist tyranny, was totally, I think, underestimated by their enemies. The tactics that they've employed have been unique insofar as they haven't gone out and fought like a standard army, if you like. They've not really battled in those formations that you'd expect. And what they've done is they've employed methods of hit and run, methods in which small groups of small units have gone in, done the operations, and then disappeared into the sand almost. I mean, that's perplexed and totally bamboozled a Saudi military which was armed to the teeth with missiles and all the latest hardware. How do you fight an army which can disappear not only into the desert, underground, overground, wherever, even into the towns and villages? You're basically fighting the people. So where are you going to find these forces to fight? Not only that, they've actually demoralized a mercenary army, because the Saudis didn't want a boots-on-the-ground situation. Because the air power failed, what they did was started to import mercenaries from Sudan, Somalia, other places. So these mercenaries that they're fighting are not dedicated to any cause or commitment, whereas the Ansarullah are fighting for their families, for their children, for their nation. There are many differences compared to this this virtual victory, I see.
Okay, well, Greg, tell us the importance of what is happening right now, because we know about the situation in Mardiv and the offensive and every day having more and more victories. The importance of capturing Mardiv.
We have to bear in mind that Mardiv is the last and only major stronghold that the Saudis and their supporters still have in central and central northern Yemen. Except for Mardiv, their entire stronghold, their entire foothold in Yemen is almost entirely concentrated in the thinly populated, be it strategically located, south and east of Yemen, which is very sparsely populated, which is not a very well-developed area when compared to the more populated areas that are still under control of the National Salvation Government and protected by Ansar Allah and their allies. So when Mardiv falls, this will be a very massive blow, not just militarily, but also economically and spiritually, mentally, for the Saudis and their allies. We already know, of course, that the Saudis, when it comes to Yemen itself, to Yemeni troops, the few Yemenis that are fighting on their side are for the majority members of the Islam Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan movement in Yemen. And we know that within the Islam Party there is a growing rift that has started, especially in Mardiv, in which some groups of the Islam Party are thinking of negotiating, and have already even offered certain venues of negotiations that so far unfortunately have not yet led to a capitulation of the city. But it is definitely a start. And one of the reasons for that being is that the National Salvation Government still to this very day offers a general amnesty to every mercenary, every Yemeni who joined the Saudi forces, who decides to defect, put down the weapons or hand in their weapons and decides to return back to civilian life. That is perfectly still, or that venue is still open. So aside from that loss of a major Islam Party stronghold, the potential loss of the last vestige of northern and central Yemeni power that the Saudis still have, there is the massive economic importance in terms of oil and gas. Not so much necessarily that the Saudis need the oil, but the oil is now at least kept out of Yemeni hands. That is their goal. Try to keep the country as poor as you can be. If that oil were to go back into Yemeni hands, and Yemen could possibly, potentially, in the near future, negotiate further economical oil deals with other countries. If the government of Sana'a could somehow manage to sell that oil on the international market again, this is a massive influx of funds again that belongs to Yemen, but so far has been kept out of Yemen for almost 7 years now. So when all these things come together, and we have to bear in mind that at this point, it's not only in Mardiv, but also the East Coast, areas have been liberated at a rapid pace. Just today, there was a report that the Kilo 16 area, which is the major road between Sana'a and Hodeidah, mm-hmm. has been liberated and has been reopened after 3 years of Emirati blockade. The Emiratis have retreated. The Yemenis have moved back in, and the road, the direct routes between the major cities of Sana'a and the major port city of Hodeidah, both of them who are in hands of the National Salvation Government, that road is open again now. There is a direct line of transportation from the port to Sana'a. All these things taken together represent a complete and total breakdown of Saudi and Emirati stranglehold in central Yemen, which means that they will have to withdraw almost completely to the south, to Aden and to Hadramaut.
Okay. Well, Said Mohsen, let's look at the Saudi allies, such as the United States and Britain. Both countries had discussed the need to curtail sales of further military equipment to Saudi Arabia, but we've seen the opposite. The Biden administration has recently approved $500 million more. Why do both these Western countries continue to show their hypocritical policies when it comes to Yemen? On the one hand, it says that the violence must cease and civilians should not be killed. On the other hand, we see that they continue to support the Saudi regime.
Well, the entire strategy and policy of Zionist exceptionalism across the world, and of course the domination of that region and the plunder of the resources of that region, has relied fundamentally on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been the one that has been buying a lot of the nations around that region with its dollars, persuading them, maintaining a status quo, making sure that they didn't rebel against the Zio-American order in that region. So Saudi Arabia has been a linchpin, really, for Anglo-Zionist policy and imperialism in that region, keeping all of the nations to heel. Of course, the reality is that the situation is changing. The resistance axis has fundamentally changed the dynamics in this region. For the relevance of Yemen, of course, whilst it was under the Saudi yoke, Yemen was not allowed to access its nickel, gold, copper, cobalt. You know, the oil and gas fields have been mentioned, but there's been a huge amount of wealth which has been suppressed by the Saudis. They've not allowed the Yemeni rulers who were their puppets to unearth any of those. You've also got this entire situation, for instance, with the outcome of the current situation changing the face of West Asia, potentially. What happens in Marib is no small thing. It could literally change the face of West Asian geopolitics and geoeconomics. Firstly, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait leads straight to the Suez, so that immediately hits Israel and Egypt. If the Ansarullah were to take control of that entire strait, it would cause huge problems for the likes of Israel and Egypt in their strategies and policies. It would be a win-win for the likes of China and the Islamic Republic of Iran, who would essentially have a major ally on the Arabian Peninsula, a diehard ally in a way. But this has been hard won. The 13 out of 14 districts that have been now defeated or brought under control by the Ansarullah have come at a cost of many, many lives. But they are now at the point where only the city itself is running free, and they have maybe one base, a Saudi base in the region, which is there, which will very likely easily be overcome.
Okay.
80% now, if this happens, 80% of the Yemeni population will be governed by Ansarullah. That is huge. And they, as my colleagues stated earlier, they control the water and the oil of the nation, which actually will boost, give a morale boost to the entire resistance movement there, if you like. So it's no mean feat. If this actually goes through, even the likes of the United Arab Emirates, who control the ports down in the south currently, and who nurture Al-Qaeda, ISIS types in their midst, all will be under a huge, if you like, decision-making process they'll have to go to, because already Dubai and Abu Dhabi have been threatened by drones and missiles by the Ansarullah, but they haven't gone for their jugular. The Saudis have tasted that threat very, very consistently, but it remains to be seen that if UAE is turned on, how long they would even stay around
okay.
in the south once it falls.
All right. Well, Brett, a former Trump official, David Schechner, has said that the U.S. must prepare itself for the Saudis losing in Yemen. What does this mean exactly? I mean, on the one hand, is it that Washington actually realizes that the Yemeni army and people will be victorious soon? And on the other hand, if it does realize that, why then does it continue to support what Riyadh is doing?
I think we must not underestimate, of course, the power of what is called the war hawks in the United States, both in the Pentagon, in the White House, in the State Department, and in the House of Representatives in the United States. There is a massive support base of both the typical neoconservative war hawks, as well as the war hawks on the liberal side. And of course, something that must never be forgotten, the Zionist lobby, which has a massive influence, unfortunately, still to this day, in United States policies. And you see with people like it starting in with Obama and continuing under Trump, and now as well continuing under Joe Biden, that on both sides of the aisle, be they Democrat or Republican, you have those people who are diehard, dyed-in-the-wool supporters of the Zionist project, who are backed by the Zionist lobby, who are bought and in the pocket of the lobbies of the military arms industry, and Joe Biden is most definitely a very good example of a quote-unquote progressive liberal war hawk, because he has been in the pocket of these lobbies since decades already, so this should not be surprising. Of course, what we do see now is that there are more and more. Recently, there were 30 senators just a few days ago who in the U.S. Senate have proposed a total ban on supporting Saudi Arabia. These are people who have seen that there is no point in supporting this war any longer because their defeat is already certain. And these are people who most likely are not considered, have not been bribed yet, or are not considered important enough by the lobby to necessarily buy them. The interesting thing is that both Trump and Joe Biden, when they were running for president, they both of them agreed and promised to their electorate and were elected partially by people who wanted to stop supporting Saudi Arabia. They both promised that, both from a Republican and a Democratic point of view, that they would stop supporting Saudi Arabia. Of course, the moment they get elected, they have completely withdrawn that promise and done the absolute opposite. Because again, you know, these lobbies that are at work behind the scenes. But when you see now that how the situation is going now, I think the United States will have, and that is what this former advisor of Trump's, I think, is getting at, the United States will have to come to terms with the fact that there is no future for this war to go their way. It is as good as impossible that the Saudis will win this in a normal military way. And in order, of course, to pull as much as they can out of the fire, let's say, from a U.S. perspective, they will have to pressure Saudi Arabia to negotiate. They will have to pretend that it was not the United States is doing, but it was more like, you know, a mistake made in Riyadh and by Riyadh alone, because they don't want to happen what my colleague here said. They don't. Americans, of course, don't want Yemen to really completely go on the bandwagon of the axis of resistance. They don't want Yemen to be an ally of Iran, an ally of China, of Russia, and of the axis of resistance of Palestine, of course. In general, so they will probably try to somehow get in Yemen's good graces again in order to try to deviate the goals of the revolution.
Let me just get said, Mohsen, in 30 seconds. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brett. Just 30 seconds, said Mohsen. You heard what Brett said, that this would probably what they would try to do. Do you think that they would be successful in actually then trying to negotiate with the Yemenis and trying to prevent, as Brett had said, basically this major support or expansion of support of the resistance? How do your assessment of what's going to happen? 30 seconds. I know it's not a lot of time, but I know you can do it.
Well, very simply, no. The Americans have lost faith and trust. And not only that, let's not forget the Ansarullah have an ideological base. That ideological base is anti-tyranny, anti-imperialism. They will not drop their guard. I think if they would come to power, they will be a fair, just government, but they will not kowtow to the Israelis or to the Americans, nor will they cut deals with them.
I'd like to thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. The historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hausa, and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.